This week's show with Allison Cole of Allison Cole Embroidery is sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery. In 2022, Sassy Jack Stitchery is celebrating 5 years as your needlework supplies home. Be sure to visit Sassy Jack's website and get your kit for The Sun Always Shines at Sassy Jack's, a special design by Lindy Stitches to celebrate Sassy Jack's 5th anniversary. There are still openings for the upcoming workshop, Dance of the Wildflowers with Best Seal of Summerhouse Stitchworks, August 5 and 6. Contact Kim for details and to sign up. Also, the new Bristol sampler, Alice Ellen Usher, is available as a PDF download or as a printed chart. Don't miss out on this beautiful Bristol sampler, and thanks to the folks at Sassy Jack's for sponsoring the show. And now, on to our conversation with Allison Cole. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, for her third visit, Allison Cole. Allison, welcome.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks, Beth. Lovely to be here.
Oh, thanks for doing this in the middle of winter in Australia. Yay for you.
I wish I was in the summer with you.
Well, at 100 degrees today, I'll trade you right now.
Okay, deal.
So we got Allison to talk with us this week because she just got, well, I was going to say she just got back from Uzbekistan, but you've made, what, 3 or 4 trips since you got back, so it really isn't a just got back, but the International Festival of Gold Embroidery and Jewelry in, is it Bukhara?
Yeah, Bukhara, yeah.
Bukhara, Uzbekistan. Holy smokes, that was impressive. You were posting pictures on primarily your Facebook page, but and you were the representative from Australia. How does that happen?
Oh, well, it happened because I got a phone call from a woman called Jude, who's the president of the World Craft Council in Australia. And I get this phone call absolutely out of the blue. And she says, "Hi, you don't know me, but my name's Jude and I'm from the World Craft Council. And we'd like you to represent Australia for gold embroidery at this festival in Uzbekistan in May." And this is March.
I just
okay, for starters, you know there's a war going on over that region. And I'm thinking of Ukraine with my, you know, very bad high school geography brain. And she goes, "Oh, it's not that far from Afghanistan. It's not that close." And I'm thinking, oh, hell, Afghanistan. I didn't even think about Afghanistan.
Jeez.
So my brain just said, no. And I said, "I'm booked out 2 years in advance. I can't do something in 2 months' time. I've got classes. I said, "No, I can't do this. I'd love to do this, but I can't do this." And she goes, "Oh, I'm really, you know, disappointed." And, you know, and I just went, I kept going, "There's a war on over there." I was completely freaked out by it. So I said, no. And then I got off the phone from her and I ran out and found Steve. He just bought a new excavator and he's out digging holes, and I raced out. I just said no to something that I would absolutely love to do, but I just feel like it would be so irresponsible to go over there because, you know, there's so much going on. And he said, "Well, I would have at least said maybe. I'll think about it." And I said, "Oh, you're right." And so I ran back to the studio and I'm trying to find this lady and I'm going, I didn't even know there was a World Craft Council, let alone an Australian division. You know, I'm a member of Craft Victoria, that's our state here in Australia that I'm a member of. I had no idea there was an Australian body, let alone a world body. And I looked up, I quickly Google it, and it's like, yep, this is a thing, and yep, Jude's the president, and there's no phone number for her. So then I'm thinking, okay, well, she rang me on the home phone. I wonder if I can do a last number display. So I'm punching buttons, hoping for the best, and it brings up a number. So I thought, oh, well, let's give it a go. So I rang it and this lady answers the phone, "Hello." And I said, "Is this Jude?" And she said, "Yes." I said, "Well, you don't know me, but I'm the idiot that said no to something that I should have said at least a definite maybe to." And she said, "I'm so glad that you've called me back. We'd love to have you." I said, "Give me a couple of days to think about it." And so I just went, yeah, I have to do this. It just sounded amazing. I said, could you send me more information? And she said, well, we don't even have a lot of information, but I'll send you what we've got. So 2 days later, I said yes, and then I had to try and make space for it. So we had to move a retreat. I had to cancel a class. And I had a class coming up in Lismore in New South Wales, which has had extreme flooding this year. And I contacted them and I said, do you want this class? And they said, no. And I said, good, let's just cancel it. I thought I could move the retreat to that weekend. Yeah. So it just meant that we could move everything around and make it happen. So so we did, because usually at, 3 months, well, so it was 6 weeks' notice. And at 6 weeks' notice, I usually would just laugh and say there's no way known. But
So 6 weeks to fly to the Middle East, or no, it's not the Middle East, no. Eastern
Central
Europe.
Asia. Yeah, Central yeah. Asia it is.
Yeah, right. Represent an entire continent country.
Yeah.
Yeah, no pressure there. Yeah.
No pressure.
Now, you had a booth there, so you had to put something together, or was that handled for you?
No, we had a booth. So, yeah, they had a whole big line of tents set up, and we were right up one end. It was really funny to think that New Zealand was right up the other end. So, you'd have thought they'd maybe put us closer together. But anyway, we were right on the very end. And we were, so if you think of it like a T shape, the top of the T was a lot of the Uzbek and Kyrgyzstan stallholders. They were sort of like the regional nearby countries. And then we were the beginning of all the other international ones heading towards the old city of Bukhara. So, and we were just sitting right outside the, 1,500-year-old fort. So it was just the most amazing place to sit. And we were facing the fort. And so we had a tent. So Sultana Shamshi, who was representing Australia for jewellery, and she's from Perth. And so we didn't meet until we got to Bukhara. We were on different flights. And we were also travelling with people from the World Craft Council. So Jude and Leslie Ann and Lindy were all coming. And so two of them were also coming from Perth. Lindy was on the same flight as me coming from Melbourne. Yeah. So, we got over there, and the tents were all set up and they had a backboard. We were told to bring posters. It was amazing, the lack of information. Because one of the New Zealand girls, Australia is in the Asia Pacific region, and so we get grouped in with New Zealand, and so we had a Zoom call with a girl who had been representing at World Craft Council. So every 4 years, World Craft Council have a conference, and they pick a feature craft, and the last one was glass. So she'd gone to represent New Zealand for glass in Colquhoun. And so they said, she'll have an idea of what we're going to expect. And she said, there was rows of tents and you put up posters. And so anyway, we got there, and there's a display cabinet for each of, for Sultana and myself. Every tent had a display cabinet in it. And you could see that some countries obviously do this all the time, and they'd ordered more than one tent. So they would have their name on one tent, but Kyrgyzstan might have had three. That they could then have their jewellers and everybody, and have people selling. So there were people actually selling their everybody was very disappointed when we were saying, no, it's just display. And they were like, just a display, but how much? And I go, no, it's a sale. And how much? By the end of it, I realised that some people just wanted to know what it was worth. And so we tell them what it was worth, and then they go, whoa. So it was because their wages are like less than a quarter of what our wages are over here. So, if I was to have sold a piece of embroidery, no one would have been able to afford it who was a local.
What is the world? I'd never heard of the World Craft Council till you started mentioning it. What is their general purpose? Is it just to promote craft of all kinds?
It's to promote craft of all kinds, but it's also to promote people making a living through craft. So my general understanding of looking into at this thing every 4 years, they have a award of excellence where artisans from all over the world can put in pieces, and then if they win the award for excellence, it gets kept, which is going to go into a museum which is yet to be built, which I think is going to be in Kuwait, which is where the president is at the moment. And the and so it's more about getting helping people create sustainable livelihoods through their craft. So if you win this prize, it means that you can then sell, so say it's a bowl, a pottery bowl, you can then sell a million of those pottery bowls saying that it has won this award for excellence. It doesn't mean you can sell a basket that you've made. So you can only use it for that one item that has been recognised. And so they asked me to put in for it. I said, yeah, but I don't actually sell my craft. I sell kits for people to make my craft. And right. going through it, it sort of read like it should be environmental, sustainable, all the things that Goldwork really isn't. So I just went, yeah, I don't know that this is for me. And it really, when you look at the past winners, they're all through Thailand and India and, you know, they're emerging country. They're countries where Westerners go on holiday to buy beautiful pieces of craft. They're not, they're people who are selling through Ausfam shops and Oxfam shops and things like that, where they're helping really developing nations get their work out to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So I said I didn't want to put in for that, because if you were to win something like that, it really needs to go to somebody who needs it to derive a living from it.
Right.
Was my understanding of it. So it's about promoting craft around the world and bringing a craft community together. And I'm going to say I hadn't heard of it until 6 weeks beforehand. And while I was there, the amount of people who say, oh, so do you go to Santa Fe? Apparently there's a big thing in Santa Fe coming up where people from all these nations get together and sell their wares at Santa Fe.
And Santa Fe is in New Mexico? Like, who knew?
Yep. Yeah. Huh. In New
Mexico. Well, you know what? Now that you've said that,
yeah,
wait a
Beth,
second.
Yeah. We'll see your parents.
I was going to say, I think I've been to that, or we were going to go. It's something that my mom would go to, I'm sure, because it sounds so familiar. Now that you've said that, I'm thinking, because my mom would go and wander around in the booths and buying gifts or buying things.
And this man from India kept saying to me, oh, they won't accept me at Santa Fe. You'll have to apply and then get me in. And I'm like... it's not going to happen. The starters, I'm not taking work to sell. And second, I've already got bookings. It's just I'm not clearing a path for it. It's not happening. I'm not going. So it was a lot of networking, a lot of meeting people, and it was truly amazing. I mean, I felt kind of guilty when I left my stall, because I was supposed to be there representing my stall. If I had have had a clone of myself, it would have been brilliant, because I wanted to run up and down and look at everybody else's work. So, I'd say to Sultana, I'm going to go for a run. I'm going to go have a quick look. I'll be back in an hour, and then she'd go off for an hour. And so you could have a look at what everybody was doing. And, I really would have liked more time to have explored what the other artisans had on their stalls. So
yeah, that's the trouble having a booth. If you go to an event, if you can avoid having a booth, do so, because I know what you mean. You just feel tied to it and you want to go see things. Yeah.
Yeah. So and there were some really amazing things, and so there were people from all over the world. So and if they have traditional dress, they were wearing it. So there was a man from Mali who was so statuesque and amazing, with his blue turban wrapped around his head and draping over his shoulders, with his beautiful silver jewelry all over him. He was a jeweler. He looked like a statue. He was amazing. And he looked like he was 7 foot tall even without the turban. So he was huge. And then you've got the ladies from Hungary, and they've all got their white work aprons on over their dresses with their gold bonnets. And, they were just beautiful. So, and then, I rock up wearing a bush hat. So. Because we don't have a national dress. So we had shawls, scarves. I made scarves for us to wear, but it was too damn hot to wear them. And I took my hat. I said, it's going to be hot over there. I'm not going to go anywhere without my hat. but, you know, I don't go anywhere without a hat. Yeah. I burn very easily. And so I just lived in my hat. And even people thought it was fabulous. So even if I was sitting in my tent, I still had my hat on. So.
Now, was it mostly embroidery, mostly jewelry, or pretty much an even mix?
I would actually say there was more jewelry there than embroidery.
Oh, okay.
But there were countries who should have been represented that weren't. So, like, there was a jeweler from England, and unbelievably, there was nobody from the Royal School of Needlework. You know, it just...
Oh, my.
So it was a bit of a shock. People that I just expected would be there weren't. And I was talking to Jo Dixie, who was representing New Zealand. She trained at the Royal School back in the day with Jenny Aiden Christie and Owen Davies and Tracy Franklin. They were all in the same group that year. And
there's a batch of inept embroiderers.
I know.
Holy smokes.
I had some really cool friends.
Wow.
And I was talking to Jo, and she said she was talking to the RSN, and they thought it was a scam. So they got the email while I was invited direct from the World Craft Council, because the whole thing was in conjunction with the World Craft Council. They were actually contacted by the Uzbeki government, and they thought the email looked like a scam. So, so hopefully they'll be there with bells on next time. So,
yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah, but so there was a photographer from America. There wasn't any embroiderers from America. There was no jewelers from America. So
really?
It was not really, yeah. So it was, there were people that I thought would be there. So there were 105 countries represented at the event, but not all of them were jewelers or embroiderers. So there were, like I say, there was a photographer from America. There was a lady from Belgium who was a freelance journalist. So, you know, there were people from all over the world who'd come to participate in the conference and the goings-on at the conference and document it to get all the information out around the world about how wonderful Uzbekistan is. The whole thing was put on by the government in conjunction with their Hunamund Association, which I think is their government, like, craft body in Uzbekistan, and the Chamber of Commerce. So it really was about putting Bukhara on the map for people all around the world.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't just about their embroidery. Apparently, I was talking to one of the locals through the interpreter, and they were, so are you enjoying the festival? And it's like, you know, this has replaced our Silk and Spice Festival. Because they're on the Silk Road. So, you know, it was Silk and Spice is being traded through this area. They've decided to replace it with gold embroidery and gold jewellery, which is also what Bukhara is known for and Uzbekistan is known for. And so, you know, they were like, yeah, this is good, but, you know, is it going to bring in the tourists? And so, you know, the whole thing is about really helping their economy. So they were investing in their own people, which is, you know, something that you seldom see governments do.
Yeah.
At the opening of the embroidery school, it was really surprising to hear the two mayors. So one was the mayor of Bukhara and one was mayor of the region, speaking about how opening this embroidery school and this embroidery museum is all about employing women and empowering women and giving them a method of earning money.
Oh.
And I thought, you know, in a country in Central Asia that, you know, you often get the feeling that in some of these countries women are not terribly valued, and women's work, goodness, you don't work, you know. We are only over a border from Afghanistan where women are not allowed to work and they're not allowed to go to school anymore and they've got to completely cover up.
Yeah.
And we're in a country where you can get around in a pair of jeans and a t-shirt or a pair of shorts if you wanted. Some people were wearing shorts. So, you know, the locals were mainly still wearing like long dresses, but that was more about being cool than, you know, I think Westerners have this idea if it gets hot, you take all your clothes off. People who live in desert countries, they get hot, they wear a kaftan because it's going to keep you cool. It's going to create a breeze when you're walking. So
yeah. Yeah, they haven't figured it out. Long time ago they figured it out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So. The amount of different costumes and things that walked past us, so it was people watching and, can I take a photo of you? You look amazing. Ladies walking past with pots on their head just so that they can get noticed, I'm sure. You know, they weren't carrying anything because they needed to. They were just like just there to add ambience to the whole thing. So yeah. It was just an amazing thing. And as I said, to you before we went to air, you know, the last person I saw at my booth was from Newcastle in New South Wales, Australia, who walks up with a broad Aussie accent and a smile and says, really, Australia?
That's crazy. Yeah. That's, you know, mentioned Jenny, Aiden, Christie, and those other ladies. I mean, just some of the best talent in the business. And you obviously fit in there. And when you showed the pictures of all that gorgeous gold work and embroidery, I mean, it's just, some of it's just absolutely stunning. What is that like, given how as skilled as you are and as well known as you are? Is when you go to a place like that, are you in awe? Is it dig in? I want to learn more. What's your reaction to that?
My reaction I wanted to really see in the embroidery school, and Joe wanted to as well. So we had a driver take us to the embroidery school, and we were there for the opening. And we wanted to sit with the lady. They invited us to stitch with them and to learn the technique of what they do and how they do it. And that was really fabulous. It was so nice. And it was really funny because Joe's sitting there stitching and this lady says something to her and the interpreter says, oh, she says, you're not too bad at this. You're quite good. And Joe laughed and said, I do stitch for a living. This is what I do. You know, it's not this technique, but we do techniques that are similar. And the way that they're laying either 5 or 7 threads at a time. So they're wrapped around like a brooch or a coma. It's essentially a stick. They've got 5 or 7 threads wrapped around the stick and they're being couched down at once. And it's just been couched side to side over the top of the cardboard padding. So it's like laying plate. So it's something that Jo was actually doing in her booth. She was sitting there laying plate. It was exactly the same technique, just a different thread. It's something that we're very familiar with, but at the same time it was foreign to us because it wasn't something that we'd done or experienced. And it's something that I have looked at there and studied their embroidery before. I had one of my students who did the masterclass in gold work decided that for her ethnic piece she was going to do a book or a, well, an Uzbek rather, wedding hat. And so, you know, we were estimating how many threads they were doing and how it was being couched. And, you know, we were putting a lot more thought into making sure those 5 threads laid side by side, you know, parallel. Those ladies don't mind about that. They're just couching it and whap it over the other side and couch it again. So it's not the finest embroidery you'll ever see, but some of the older examples are. And I bought some antique hats and men's hats, and they've got really nice work on them. And it's the same technique, but it's a little bit finer than what we saw while we were there. Mm-hmm. As far as the other people, the other artisans, oh, look, it was just fabulous just seeing what they were doing and being able to try and talk to some of them about it. The young man from France, was absolutely gorgeous, and he had a train of young women following him wherever he went. He was such a sweetie. And he won the Young Embroiderer prize at the closing ceremony. I can't remember whether he got first, second or third with it, but he got the Young Embroiderer. He was 19 and he was combining sculpture and jewellery and embroidery. And what he was doing was just so creative, and it was really, really interesting work. So there were people there, like the Asuet shawls. So I have an antique Asuet shawl in my collection from Egypt, and there were ladies there representing Egypt just sitting there making them like they make them every day, you know. Yeah. You could buy one. They were like $15 apparently to buy. I said, oh, if I hadn't known that, I would have bought one. Put it with my antique one. So you know, to see these people sitting and stitching, and there was one lady was really funny. She was sitting there doing tambour work in silk, and her phone rang. And so she's got her phone under her ear and she just didn't miss a beat. And she's sitting there in a tent, you know, just plugging away with her tambour hook, going at 100 miles an hour like a sewing machine, doing the most beautiful tambour embroidery with her mobile phone perched on her shoulder, you know, so that she's still got both hands free. And it was just like this mix, you know, the same when we were at the parade, the amount of young people that were walking in the parade in their traditional dress and they're dripping in gold work and they're chatting on their mobile phones. And we're in this ancient city that's, you know, like, you know, let's say 1500 years old in front of these beautiful ancient buildings and this beautiful minaret and, you know, all this history around you and yet all these modern mobile phones and stuff. It was just an absolute clash, but it was amazing. It was fabulous.
So that sounds to me like you kind of become a sponge when in that kind of an environment and just soak up everything you can. You must have learned things and new inspirations.
Oh, yes. Yeah. No, I've been working on a project for 20 odd years where one of my mentors set me a challenge of researching gold work around the world and how it differs from country to country. And I said, well, that's good, but it differs from region to region in big countries. And then it differs in periods in time as well. And she said, we'll get to it. And so I've been doing it on and off for 20 years and I keep saying I'm going to publish it as a book and it's going to happen. And I am getting very close to actually getting to a point where I will publish it as a book. But now I've decided I'm putting Uzbekistan in it. You know, I can't go there and not represent it in the book and not show their style of gold work because it's different and it's cool. So I'm a sponge. I go around taking photos of the architecture and the tiles and the and the ground. You know, at one point I was taking a photo of the ground and it was really funny. We're in a market and my interpreter says, what are you taking a photo of now? And I said, oh, just patterns in the tiles.
Yeah.
And they were commercial brand, you know, probably only laid within the past 5 or 6 years, you know, but they've got their traditional designs printed onto the tile. Patterns in the tiles themselves. And she just shook her head and was looking at me. I said, oh, that's okay. My husband shakes his head like that all the time.
So I'm used to it, yeah.
This is nothing new.
Well, see, that's what I, you know, looking at some of those pictures, I used to edit an architectural magazine and one of our advertisers was Tile of Spain. And they represented tile artisans from all over Spain. And some of the pictures they would send of some of the tile work was just amazing. You just sit there and just stare at it. And then when I saw some of the stuff in your photos, I thought, oh, you must have just eaten that up because the shapes and colors and the designs just have to be inspiration, just one after the other.
Yeah, no, it was. It was beautiful. And so this is on the old buildings and it's, you know, we were told that when it was occupied, I don't know if occupied is the right word, but by Russia, when it was part of the USSR, Russia didn't allow them to do any of their traditional crafts. They weren't allowed to practice any of their own things. They had to do everything that the Russians did. And so apparently it all went underground. And so they didn't stop doing it. They just couldn't visibly do it. And so the minute that the USSR broke up, they then set about repairing all of these buildings and fixing all of the things that the Russians destroyed and bringing things back. And it's interesting. I'm used to traveling Europe where and I guess, you know, I've traveled a bit of Asia, but where you go into churches, cathedrals, mosques, whatever, and, you know, like say the Alhambra in Spain or you know, a cathedral in England or France or Italy, and it's still either in use or it's still as it was. To go into some of these beautiful old buildings that you're thinking, oh, I wonder what they're doing here, and it's souvenirs. So it's just a shell, and whatever it was used for, it's not used for that anymore, and they don't have any of the original furnishings or things in there. It's just being repurposed into a building to put something. So, you know, there was one building I could see people. I actually saw a man on the roof, and they said, "Oh no, no, it's against the law to be on the roof." I said, "I definitely saw a man on the roof," and I said, "Well, maybe he was a maintenance man or something. Maybe he was working there." And they said, "Oh, he would have to be because, you know." And I said, "Oh, so what's that building? Can we go in that one?" And, "Oh no, you can't go in that one. That one was still their Islamic school, and it's still in operation as an Islamic school." So, so that one would have been beautiful to see inside because it's been all restored on the inside, but it's not for tourists. So, you know, you could take photos outside of it, but you weren't welcome to go inside of it. So, but, you know, so we went in to one and this lady was selling textiles and she's like, "Come in, come in, come in." And I'm like, and some of these places I'm a bit dubious to walk in the door because it's really hard to get out unless they've extracted some money from you. And everybody wants you to come in their door, you know. And so anyway, I go in and she says, "No, you must come in and see the building." And I was like, "Okay, you've got me now." So I went in and it was like all the walls were painted and it was just, and she's in there selling her embroidery and it was beautiful. But, you know, whatever the original purpose of this room was, you know, it was spectacularly painted. So, amazing plaster work and stuff in it. Yeah. So it was, yeah, so I was really glad and I was happy to spend some money in there. So.
Did they give you an interpreter there when you came? Was that?
Yes, yes. So each artist received a volunteer interpreter. So we had two wonderful young people looking after Sultana and I, and it was Jasmine and Alesha, and they were just really, really fun kids. They're 19 and they were studying English at university. So we found out that we were really, really lucky. I mean, we knew we were lucky because we had the best two kids, because they just said, "Oh, okay, so now we'll pack up and we'll take your stuff back and let's take you sightseeing and let's do this and what do you want to do and what do you want to see, you know, and are you hot?" And they'd just disappear and come back with drinks, or, you know, they really looked after us, and our trip wouldn't have been the same without those two beautiful young people. But it was funny because other people were saying, "Oh, you know, my guide's going to be a cardiac surgeon." So wasn't actually as good on the English as what ours was, because ours are actually English students. So, ours were studying to be interpreters, whereas, yeah, a lot of the volunteers, they were studying to be other things. But they were all university students and they were all using it to improve their English. Which, you know, so they're volunteering, and our guide said at the end, "Thank you so much for not rolling your eyes if we got a word wrong." And I said, "Why would we do that?" They said, "Oh, some people were." You know, some of the interpreters were saying that, you know, the people they were looking after were getting frustrated if they couldn't find the right word, or, you know, and I just went, "Oh, you know, they're students, they're learning." And, you know, so we were throwing them some curveballs and giving them some Australianisms to their English. So,
oh boy.
just to say, well, you know, when you come to Australia,
right.
We wouldn't actually say that. We'd say this. And I said, you know, there's English and then there's Australian English and there's American English. You know, they're not all exactly the same. So they're the same words, but they're phrased not necessarily the same. So, you know, and then you've got, you know, our shortened version of, you know, yes, we say hello and we say hi, but we also say g'day, you know, and it was interesting watching them get their head around g'day and that it's just a shortened firm form of good day.
Yeah.
You know, but it was just lovely. And their class actually caught up with me, and I had the whole, we had like 15 kids and their teacher come to say, "Oh, can we talk to you? Can we say hello? Can we practice some English? You know, can you tell us about where you come from?"
Oh.
And everywhere I went, people go, "Oh, Australia, kangaroos." And they all put their hands up in front like little paws and start bouncing up and down. And it's like, "Kangaroos." And so I pull out my phone and go, "Yeah, this was the day before I left." And I'd show them, you know, there was a dozen kangaroos in our backyard the day before we left.
Yeah.
And then they just look at you with wide eyes. I say, "Yeah, not everybody in Australia has this, but we do."
Well, that's great, because, I mean, that's a way to connect with other people. I think that's the thing about travel that I like, is really meeting people who live there and learning something about them and learning something about their culture. Because if not, you're just seeing buildings. Yeah, you see things, but to connect with the people, I mean, that's what looked like it was so much fun. Like, you were taking pictures of people and besides their work, which was beautiful.
When Steve and I travel, we've always traveled that way. I remember when we went our first kind of major holiday away overseas together was to Thailand. And the first guide, all she wanted to do was shove us into buffet, spaghetti bolognese. So I'm in Thailand. I don't want to eat spaghetti bolognese. I want to eat Thai food. I want fish cakes. And I want, I want to eat what you eat. And she got a kickback from the buffet. So, she just wanted to put us in buffet. So we just refused to eat. We were eating street. Everyone's saying, don't eat street food when you're away. We always eat street food when we're away. If it's cooked fresh in front of you and it looks like it's cooked through, it's fine. It was kind of funny. So we always try to travel that way, and the really fabulous part about being in Booker and wearing my hat is it didn't matter where we walked, people would run up to you and go, where are you from, can I take a photo with you? And and you felt like a movie star. They didn't know who you were. They didn't even know where you were from, you know. But it was like, you're different. And you looked around. I was probably the whitest people, you know, in a country of everyone with beautiful golden skin. And so they want to take your photo and they want to practice their English. So everybody is trying to learn English. So they have their native Uzbeki language, and probably more than half of them, I think, still speak Russian, because all the older people had to speak Russian when they were part of the USSR. So the two main languages there are Russian first and then their local language. And then, you know, I think they know that if they want to open up to tourism and have visitors and have the money that comes with that, then you need to have English skills as well. And so, you say, they've got universities training people up to be interpreters, but also just people would run up through the street and grab you and go, hello. Say hello. And then you know, and it was really funny. We're sitting on our booth, you know, they're like 10-year-olds, and they'd run up and their little heads would pop up above the table, and then they go, hello, and then they run away. And then they come back and do it again. And it was a game. It was just so nice. And so I'd stop and I'd say hello, we always would stop and talk to people. It took us forever to get anywhere because we'd always just stop and talk. And so, well, which way are you walking? We're walking this way. Do you want to walk with us? And so we'd be walking and chatting with them, it was really a fabulous experience. So,
oh, that's great fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
The traditional dress looks like you saw so many different types.
Yes. Yeah. So they get married wearing gold work. Both bride and groom wear gold when they're married. And then the bride, our interpreter was telling us how the bride then wears her gold dress for basically the first year of her marriage. I don't think she's wearing it to the supermarket, into the market, but I think it's like any time that she's going out. So if she, you know, if she's got an event or a family gathering or whatever, you then wear this gold dress still, so that everybody knows that you're a new bride for the first year. And I thought that was kind of cool. Get more than one use out of your wedding dress.
Well, wait a minute now. I got to have a talk. I got to have a talk with our daughter. Now, she only wore it once. What?
I've worn mine three times. So only one wedding, but I've worn it. I got to wear my wedding dress three times. I went in the Bride of the Year competition. So, and then a year later, I was asked as a winner of Bride of the Year to actually go in to the local television station and have an interview about for advertising the next year's Bride of the Year. Yeah. So I was sitting in there as an old married chook in my wedding dress on the television. It was really bizarre. But yeah, no, these ladies, they wear their gold dress. And then everywhere we went, there were people dancing and singing and playing music, and they're all in traditional dress. Our very first day, there was a parade that went through the town, and it was all traditional dress, and it was just amazing. And there were so many different styles and types of their traditional dress, because not only are they known for their gold work, but they're also known for their ICAT weaving. So, you know, there were ones that came through that were just wearing ICAT, beautiful, beautiful woven fabrics, you know, and then you've got the heavy velvet covered in gold, and then you have people that were wearing that over the top of the ICAT. So, you know, there was lots and lots of different styles and facets. And so whether that's regional or, or religious, because I'm trying to take it all in and ask my interpreter questions, and every now and then I'd turn around and I'd realize that I was nowhere near the rest of the people that I was supposed to be with. I've just kind of been drawn into what I'm looking at, and everybody else has kept walking. It was just really amazing. And then at the closing ceremony, they had it was an amazing singing, dancing spectacular, and they had first of all a whole lot of ladies came out carrying a like a signpost, like at the Olympic Games, represent one for every country, and they called out all the names of all the countries that participated. So that was really amazing, and they're all in traditional dress doing that. And then after the awards part, so they had like speeches and things next, and then they did the awards, and then after the awards they did like the story of the Silk Road, and everybody came out in traditional dress from each of those traditional regions, and it was all set to music and it was all dancing. And so, there were places, people dressed representing China and Japan and, all the way through to Europe. So coming out in a ball gown at the end. So it was, that was pretty amazing. And then there was another where they did in song and dance, the story of Bukhara and how the city of Bukhara came to be there. And so it's all gold work. And then there's music and dancing and traditional music and dancing. And then out comes an opera singer and starts singing the most beautiful opera. Yeah. So, it was an amazing night. And it was almost sensory overload.
Yeah.
With the costumes and everything and the ICAT and the gold work and the just everything. And there were two orchestras, a traditional Western orchestra and then one of their one with their own traditional instruments. And so depending on what they were portraying, it was depending on which orchestra was playing. So yeah. It was a very big budget event, which I'm not sure how much of that should have been in the opening ceremony, but it was cancelled due to the sandstorm we had. So, it was sensory overload. It was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you encounter threads or cloth that you had to have for your own stitching designs?
Oh, it's really funny. So I was determined I wanted to come home with thread, and while we're at the embroidery school, we found out where we could buy some thread. And so they sent us to a market, so that my interpreter organised a car and she took us to the market. And we get there and they go, oh, no, we haven't got it. We've just got already embroidered things. And so she then sent us to somewhere else, and then they sent us to somewhere else. And we finally find someone at the market who's got the gold thread, and it comes on a cone, and it's like 2,000 metres and made in China. And it's just stuff like we'd put on our sewing machine or overlocker over here. Yeah. So it's not like it's anything special. It's really just a cone of fine metallic sewing machine thread. So, and it was $2 a cone. So I grabbed a couple for me and one for Joe. and when we get back, the lady we were beside, the lady from Brazil, she was doing beautiful jewelry made from a grass from the Amazon. So it's a grass that turns gold at a particular time of the year. And if you harvest it at that time, it stays gold, keeps this golden colour. And so she's working with local people to create jewellery out of that, which she then sells. So she's, it's good for everybody and very much a sustainable thing when it's just grass. She said she wanted to come to Australia. I said, I don't know how you're going to go getting grass past customs. But anyway, we'll see. I would find out a bit more information about, because they may charge you more to fumigate your jewellery than what you're selling it for. So, I got back one day, I'd gone for a run around, and she's sitting there and she's got bags and bags of silk thread. And they just look like bales of straw, okay? They weren't wound, they weren't, They weren't on cards. They weren't on cones. They were just these round balls about the size of a basketball of threads. It just looked like the biggest bird's nest snag you've ever seen. And she, I said, oh, what's happening? I said, is this for sale? And she goes, oh, this lady is going to sell me some silk. And it was pearl silk. I said, are you taking all of it or are you taking some of it? Because I'd be interested in some. She goes, oh, I was going to take all of it. I go, okay, you take it. That's all right. I don't need it. You know, so I need things I can replicate and get more of. So, and I wasn't going to be able to get more of it. But she said, this is amazing. Watch this. And they had it, the way it was all packed, it didn't matter where, you don't grab an end, you grab a middle. And you pull from the middle and it's like pulling out of a lark's head knot. It just pulled out. And it didn't matter how many you pulled, they all came out. Without a snag, absolutely. And I was just like, that just didn't compute. That shouldn't happen. I have no idea how they packed it the way they packed it. But as I say, it's like a snag the size of a basketball, but it didn't matter what you pulled. So long as you didn't pull on an end, it came out. Huh. So that was weird. And then on our last day in Tashkent, a thief had said to me, somebody had told him that this market you can buy silk thread. So we pile in a taxi. So there's a young guy from Laos. There's three people from Thailand and myself and a thief who's from India. And we're piled into two taxis and we're screaming through the streets to get to this market so that we can get some thread. And we had a limited time of how long we could spend there. And, you know, and we're using interpreter on a phone to ask somebody, you know, where do we find this? And he goes, oh, all the way down there and turn right all the way down there. So this market was huge, absolutely massive. And it had like a big indoor shopping center next door to it and this massive outdoor market. But it was kind of like sheds, but open on the sides, like our Vic Market is in Melbourne. It was absolutely massive. So anyway, and we're running through it, and it's just all fabric, but it's just all polyester.
Oh, no.
We're just running through this market. Then we stop and we show them the phone, and they go and they motion and they point down this way. And so we go tearing down that way. And it's like, I've never seen such a huge fabric market full of rubbish fabric. Oh, jeez. I mean, there was some pretty things as well, but it wasn't even cotton, most of it. It was it was mainly poly, and it was like, and we were going, no. And then a thief found a seller who was Indian, and he asked him, I'd actually speak to him. So he spoke to him. He goes, oh, well, there's a factory that sells it direct, and it's about 5 kilometres from here. Oh. And we didn't have time, and it was to go on a wild goose chase that we didn't actually have an exact address of. So that little trip came up empty. So I came home with my two cones of very cheap metallic thread.
That's all you could get out of it, huh?
But I will still play with and I will cherish. And I bought a beautiful pair of scissors from, there was a man that I walked past every day to go to our booth. We had to walk past this man who was hand making scissors. And we kept looking at him. And about the third time I walked past him, I was like, yeah, okay, here's my money. I need a pair of scissors. So. So I bought a pair of scissors, but I've got lots of I did buy some ICAT fabric, just cotton. I didn't buy silk. There was a nice piece of cotton that was sort of a red and white pattern that spoke to me. I really just wanted a piece to say that I had a piece of their beautiful fabric. I probably won't do anything with it, but and if I do, it's like the width of what you have from a backstrap loom. So if you're in Thailand and they're using a backstrap loom, it's a scarf width wide. So that's what this is. The really incredible way was how they measured it. They don't measure it with a tape measure. So you pick out your bundle of fabric and then they open it up. So if you imagine that it opens into halves and then each of those open out again. So it's 4 folds, and that's 1 meter wide. So the whole lot after that is just layered backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards 1 meter wide. So you say you want 2 meters, they just count 2 and cut along the edge, and then they fold it back up the same way. So it meant that you didn't have to fuss with tape measures and rulers, and because one of the other sellers that was in a little shop, she was busy with a ruler trying to measure out the length of this piece of fabric, whereas these guys, every single fabric they had was folded, that all they had to do was lay it flat, unfold it once, unfold it twice, and that's a meter.
They knew how to turn product, yeah.
I thought that they definitely, in a market situation, that was really good. That was very cool.
So talk about this, is it Nurzat Zeenbek from Kyrgyzstan?
Nurzat was the most amazing woman. So we went to a fashion parade, and there was they were mainly Uzbek fashion designers, and they were all using basically gold work and some beading. And they were either showing traditional dress or contemporary versions of traditional dress or just contemporary Western dress, which, I have to say, they were beautiful, some of the things we saw, really amazing wearable things. And then Nurzat came out, and she's a felter from Kyrgyzstan, and I really love felt. I've always loved felt, and I used to make felt when I had time, and her pieces all came out, and her house is felt. She lives in a yurt, and her family, we had dinner with her one night, and her family were saying, they have three yurts, and the oldest one is like 120 years old, and you just, if it needs repairing, you just make a bit more felt. So it was just incredible. And so she's a beautiful, the designs and things that she did, again, contemporary but still very wearable, and so I'm sitting there going, oh my god, there's no gold to be seen in this collection, and it's my favorite because I just really could relate to the beautiful natural fibers that she was using, and she'd used a lot of silk with it as well, so it was very floaty. They were just really beautiful designs, and so we had dinner together in Tashkent, and she gave a jacket to Sultana, and I was just sitting there green with envy, thinking, oh my god, you're so lucky. It's like, wow. And then she spoke very little English for us to be sitting there having dinner together without an interpreter. We were just and we were trying to do it with our phones and try and have some kind of conversation. And then she said, could I meet her in the morning? And I said, yeah. So in the morning I met her at 10 o'clock, like she said, and she gave me a beret that she'd made, and I was like, oh, it's so beautiful, it's really cool. And she put it on me with my fringe all tucked up underneath it. I look like Frank Spencer from Some Mothers Do Have Them. It's not good. Looks better with my fringe out. Anyway, so she put that on, and then she said, we went over to the desk clerk at the hotel and asked if they could interpret. And she said, have you got a few minutes and I said, well, yeah, now, no, that's fine. And she goes, okay. She said, wait here. So I had no idea what was happening. And she'd said to me earlier she'd like to collaborate with me. And I said, oh, that'd be awesome. It'd be nice, awesome to put some embroidery onto a piece of her felt. That'd be really cool.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm told to wait here, so I wait here, and the next minute she comes back and she grabs me by the hand and takes me to the lift. We went up. We were collaborating right there and then. So
oh, my.
And the motel we had in Bukhara was fairly basic, but the one we had in Tashkent was pretty flash, and they had where the desk goes along and then it drops down and it has a mat on it for you to sit your case. So she's whipped the case off and she's whipped the mat off, and the next thing we're making felt on that.
Oh my.
we're in the bathroom, and she's asked me what my favorite color is, and I've said red because it always is red. And and so she's pulling out some red fleece and some red it looked like a synthetic, like an organdy kind of fabric. And she pulls that out. She grabs a plastic bag that all her wool was in and lays that down. And then she's laying out all the felt and everything on the top of it. And I'm thinking, okay, we're doing this now. Okay. And she just, you know, gets the soap out the bathroom and we've got a cup and she's got the water. I'm just watching her. I'm like, this is awesome, you know. And the next thing you know, she's made a neck piece for me and told me that I'm going to put a pomegranate on it. I said, no worries, we'll do. So yeah. I've come home with a piece of that felt that we made in her motel room. In the meantime, my phone goes and the rest of the group I was supposed to be going out with said, are you coming? And I said, no, go without me. I'll catch you at lunchtime.
So. No way you're leaving that, right? Yeah.
We're collaborating now.
I'm making felt in Ersatz's motel room. You know, hotel room. It was just really, it was surreal and it was really amazing. And it was so beautiful. And she's just such a lovely person. And yeah, so she sent me home with this piece of felt. So when I get the couple of jobs done that I have to do in the meantime, then I'll put a pomegranate on it and I'll send it back to her. So
that's great fun. Wow.
Yeah. So no, it's just very cool. So
the trip you turned down and then decided to think about was more than worth it.
Oh yeah. Yeah, more than worth it, and you know it was a roller coaster. There were, you know, a couple of times where I had three nights in a row where I basically hadn't slept. Like the flight over there was hell. the night in the Delhi airport was not pleasant. I got food poisoning on the plane. So I was going, oh my God, I should have just said no to this. I should be at home, you know. So it was a bit of a roller coaster that, you know, every time something happened. Like I say, we were told to bring all these posters and everything else, and the posters went up. 4 hours later, we're hit by a sandstorm and everything's destroyed. All the posters are gone. I saved two of my four posters, and when we came back the next day, the cleaners had thrown them in the bin. good value for money there. So you know, for every wonderful, you know, every time something really negative and made me think I shouldn't have come, then something really truly wonderful happened, and it was like, I'm so glad I'm here. And it was really funny. Someone asked me while I was over there, you know, so I suppose you'll come back to the next one, see as you won the prize. And I'm like, oh, I don't know, it's kind of like having a baby. I think I'd need to forget some parts of it first.
Yeah.
You know, before I come back. But, you know, I've been home for, you know, a week and a half, 2 weeks now, and I'd go back in a heartbeat. And I said right from the word go, I'd go back to Bukhara in a heartbeat, and Uzbekistan, definitely. Mm. I would never transit through India again. But I would go back to Bukhara in a heartbeat. And if they asked me to come back to the event in 2 years' time, the answer is yes, I'd love to. It was really... It really was great. And I think if you did it a second time, I wouldn't be running around wanting to look at the buildings and things as much as well. I'd be able to immerse myself just in the other artisans. But they say we had kind of set times that we were on display. And so the times that I was free to run around, so were they. So there wasn't anything to see on the stands anyway. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it really was memorable. It was amazing. So.
Yeah, we skipped right over best gold embroidery organization, second place. You got recognized.
Oh yeah, yes. That I nearly fell through the floor when they called my name out for that. It was like, hang on, I better put my bag down and put my phone down and put my jacket on and run up to the stage. It was wasn't expecting it at all. So that was truly truly amazing. It was very cool.
What a trip. That's great. Yep.
Yeah. So no, it was amazing.
Yeah. Okay. So back here at home, what do we got coming up from Allison Cole Embroidery? You got a cyber class coming and caskets.
There's all sorts of things happening. So at the minute I've got the monthly display at Embroidery House at the Embroiderers Guild in Malvern is a retrospective of my work. That's on for all of June. And that earliest piece in there is from when I was about 15. And the most recent piece in it is a piece I finished last year while I was on holiday.
What's that like to string up an exhibit that basically takes you through your entire life?
Oh, it's cool. It was, you know, they left it up to me what to put up. So that they invited me, the board invited me, would I like to do the monthly display as thanks for all the work I put in when I was heading up the Diamond Jubilee Committee for their 60th anniversary, which was 2020. And, you know, we got a few events off the ground and everything else just got cancelled. So so they wanted to recognise that and say thank you and give me you know, a chance to put up a monthly display of my work. And I said, yeah, that'd be awesome. What do you want? They said, oh, whatever you like. So I thought, oh, I'll make it a retrospective because that'll be interesting for people rather than just looking at pieces that they've probably seen, you know, plenty of times. There's, you know, half of the gallery is stuff that they is not on my website or things like that. So majority of people wouldn't have seen. And yeah, it was cool. It's funny, I was there the other day and someone said, oh my goodness, your house must be empty. And I said, there's only one piece here that was hanging in my house. And there's only about six empty hooks in the studio. So, you know, I can fill a gallery out of stuff that's just stored in cupboards. So it's not hard. I have a lot of work. So
hey,
it's kind of funny.
So
we got cyber classes coming up. Yeah, so the Toadstool one is in progress at the moment and the next one coming up is Royal Butterfly. And it's the last time that one's going to run because some of the supplies in it have become unavailable. So I'm just going to discontinue as a project. So
Now that's a cyber class, the Royal Butterfly. So
it is, yeah.
And sign-ups available now?
Yes, yeah, sign-ups are available now. The caskets you mentioned, yes, Steve is busy working on the latest batch of caskets. He puts them together in groups because it's more streamlined to do that. So he's out in the shed as we speak working on caskets. we have somebody that cuts all the pieces for us, and then the minute that arrives,
your people.
All together.
Your people.
I pack them very well. So it's actually a really cool collaboration because we're working with a number of local people in producing these caskets. So Steve has designed them and is assembling them, and it was the fifth prototype over about an eight-year period. It was that. We were working on the design for these caskets, and it was always just going to be one for me. But then it turned into, well, if we're going to do one for you and put all this effort in, we might as well sell them. So I said, well, as long as you don't mind making them, because I can't do that. So, and we have a local girl who was doing all of the prototypes for us, and then when it came to actually doing the ones that we're selling, she said, oh, look, my machine's not going to be able to do that kind of volume. So she said, what I'll do is I will outsource it to another one. So she sourced another local person. So she organises the timber and then she gets him to cut it and then she brings it back to us and then Steve assembles them. And then we have another person who makes bespoke cardboard boxes. So they're being made. They're double walled and I wanted them to slide one inside the other so that you ended up with four walls so that they're fully protected. So they're, when they're mailed out, they're wrapped in bubble wrap. They're in their bespoke box. And then that then gets put into a mailing box with recycled, you know, the popcorn pellet things around that. So we haven't had anyone say that they've not arrived in anything other than pristine condition. So and we've been shipping them all around the world. So they've gone to America and England and Canada and New Zealand. The orders, we've got two orders ahead of us at the moment. So essentially they're filled on a first in best dressed, you know, we as the caskets are finished, then that next lot of orders go out. So there are two people patiently waiting at the moment. I think one's in America and one's in Melbourne. So, but they're really good. And I'm teaching the masterclass in stumpwork. I'm teaching for the West Australian Guild next year. So I've got five trips over to Perth teaching for them. And they're going to be creating pieces. And so I think a lot of them are going to be working on panels, but some of them might be doing mirrors and caskets as well. I'm not sure. It's up to them what they want to work on. Yeah. So yeah. I'm just teaching them the techniques.
No boredom for you then.
Oh, no, I don't have any boredom in my life, no. And then coming up, I think the next issue of Inspirations has got a piece of my work in it. And their next publication, A Passion for Needlework 4, which comes out in October, also has a piece of my work in it. So they asked me if I would do a piece. The photo shoot was at the White House in Daylesford, which I know nothing about, but they asked if I could do, seeing as I've got so many beautiful wildflower designs, would I be able to do something with wildflowers from that area? And that area is actually not that far away from here, so we share a lot of the same wildflowers. So some that actually grow here in our backyard, but others that don't, that are just from that Daylesford area. So designed that specially for them. So those that were following my Facebook at the beginning of this year would have seen me working on that bouquet of flowers. So that's going into Passion for Needlework 4.
Those guys, their publications are just top notch. It really is.
Yeah, they do a great job.
Yeah, they really do.
Yeah. Yeah, you know that you can give it to them and entrust them that they're going to do something beautiful with it. So it's really good, yeah.
Yep. Now, I've mentioned more than once, even if you never do a project, just to have them, just to ogle is worth everything, yeah.
Yep. No, they make a good coffee table book.
Yep. All right, Allison, thank you. Wow, that was fun.
Yeah. You're welcome.
You learned so much.
My pleasure.
Yep.
Yeah, so good to hear all about that trip, because I was just so curious about your experience.
Beth, you would have loved it. You honestly, if you get the opportunity, say since I've come back and I think, oh, now who did that and who did what? And I go and I just do a quick Google and it comes up on all these different tourism websites that there were so many tour companies actually promoting being in Bukhara at that time. To be there for the festival. So, it's not just for their locals and it's not just promoting themselves. You know, it would be just a fabulous time. I know so many of my students have said, oh, we'll have to go in 2 years' time and have a holiday over there, because they would love to go there and see what I saw. So, yeah. It really was beautiful. And, considering my initial concerns of safety, I did not feel unsafe for 1 second. After the closing ceremony, we had to make our way to a hotel that I didn't even know where it was to collect our prize and go. And we got a taxi there, but he didn't want to wait for us, so we couldn't get a taxi back. And so we just walked through the streets of Bukhara. We got back at 1:45 in the morning, and at no point did we feel that we weren't safe. It was just, we stopped, we grabbed something to eat, we got some drinks, we were just walking around through the town in the middle of the night, and we felt very calm, and when we were in the old part where all of this festival was held in the old part of Bukhara, with all the historic buildings, that place really slowly started jumping about 10 o'clock at night,
It was just sort of incredible.
Exactly like Europe, in the middle of the afternoon there were a lot of tourists around, but there were a lot of locals when it got to after dark, that it's cooler. Why would you go out in the middle of the day?
Right.
So, a lot of locals were out because the festival was on and they wanted to see people like us who weren't going to be there in the night time. But at the night time, they were out strolling around, getting ice cream, getting food, enjoying the music, enjoying everything that was going on. It was very much like being in Italy, but, that evening promenade time, it was really nice. Didn't feel unsafe at all. So it was really good.
That's great. You can just relax and enjoy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we did.
Yeah. Yep. All right, Allison. Thanks so much for making the time and sharing the stories. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me back again, Gary and Beth. It's been a pleasure.